Chapter 41. By the end of the day, Mary had covered sheet after sheet in Greek script. Her eyes ached as she took off her glasses and rubbed them. She decided to carry her work upstairs and review what she had done. It would be interesting to see if her most recent efforts showed any improvement on her early scribbles. In her bedroom, she spread the pages over her dressing table, lit two candles, and was examining them closely when Mrs. Hill came in. At first, she busied herself with a little tidying and folding, but soon she came and stood beside Mary, peering curiously at the papers.
"What is this? I haven't seen writing like this before."
"It is Greek, Mrs. Hill, as it was spoken in ancient times, the language of great philosophers and poets."
"Is this what Mr. Collins is teaching you? How to speak and write Greek?"
"Yes. He has been kind enough to instruct me when he has the time." Mrs. Hill stood up and looked directly at Mary.
"He seems to find the time, doesn't he? You're in the library together most afternoons."
"It is only for a few hours a day. It does not call him away from his other duties, and I have little enough else with which to occupy myself."
"He sees more of you than he does of Mrs. Collins. They don't study together, do they?"
Mary felt alarm mount in her. Her mouth grew dry and her heart began to beat faster. "That is because she has no taste for this kind of learning. It does not interest her." Mary sat down heavily on the bed. Mrs. Hill, seeing her distress, hurried to her side.
"I did not mean to upset you, really I did not.
Has Mrs. Collins spoken to you about this? Has she made any mention of it?"
"Lord, no!
She is a close woman and gives little away. She would never speak to me on such a subject. And listen, Miss Mary, you mustn't imagine I believe you've done anything wrong. I know that isn't in your nature. But you don't understand yet how the world works. People put two and two together and make five. Sometimes just the look of a thing can be enough to cause trouble."
Mary sat very still, dumbstruck with shame.
"I had to warn you," went on Mrs. Hill. "I care for you too much to keep quiet. Something had to be said."
Mary nodded. When it was clear she did not intend to reply, Mrs. Hill left the room, closing the door quietly behind her. Once she was gone, Mary buried her face in the pillows.
How could she have been so stupid?
Because she knew there was nothing wrong in those scholarly afternoons, she had not considered how they might look to others. She had enjoyed them so much she had allowed her pleasure to overwhelm her judgment. Had she learned nothing at all from her experience with John Sparrow? She had sworn then she would never again allow herself to act so thoughtlessly, yet here she was, making the same mistake again. She was a fool, an ignorant, blundering fool, too heedless or too willful to have imagined the consequences of her behaviour. She lay back on her old bed and thought of Charlotte. If Mrs. Hill had noticed the time Mr. Collins spent in her company, and the pleasure he seemed to derive from it, Mary had no doubt his wife had seen it too. Charlotte's anger at the dinner table was not a sudden explosion of resentment, provoked by the pride Mr. Collins had so tactlessly displayed as Mary recited the Greek alphabet. It had been simmering away for some time, stoked up by the hours Mary spent with her husband, by the satisfied expressions on their innocent, uncomprehending faces as they emerged from the library after a profitable afternoon study. If Mary had not thought it possible to feel jealousy over a man one did not love, she knew better now. It took her most of the night to decide what to do. A braver woman might have gone to Charlotte and tried to explain the truth of the matter, insisting that their behaviour had been utterly misunderstood, but Mary knew she could not do this. Speaking directly of it to Charlotte gave the situation a significance it did not deserve, and Mary suspected she would not acquit herself well under Charlotte's accusing stare. She would stumble and bluster, and in her confusion might imply a guilt she did not deserve. Charlotte would be merciless,
and Mary was not equal to combating her scorn. She was rather afraid of the person Charlotte had become, and was certain such an encounter would not end well. But something must be done, and Mary soon understood what was required. The Greek lessons must be given up, and she could spend no more time alone in Mr. Collins's company. As she lay in the darkness, she knew this was the correct decision, the only possible choice. But when she contemplated what it would mean, it was a bitter prospect. Yet again, she was to surrender her own enjoyments in order to gratify the perceptions of others. She had obediently dismissed John Sparrow when told propriety demanded it. Now she was about to relinquish all the satisfaction her new studies had begun to afford her, in order to avoid any suggestion of an intimacy she had not encouraged, did not feel, and was certain did not, in fact, exist. Dutifully, she asked herself, as she had done many times during her sleepless night, if she was deceiving herself, searching her heart for the smallest hint she hoped for anything more than friendship from Mr. Collins. As always, she found nothing, no evidence of any suppressed tender sentiments. No, the feelings that Longbourn had provoked in her were of a very different kind. When she walked through the well-tended rooms, when she watched Charlotte busy in the vegetable garden, and above all when she saw her take young William in her arms and kiss his downy head, there was an emotion that coursed through her with such power that she thought everyone must notice it. But it was not love for Mr. Collins. It was a sense of deep, angry longing, a longing for the life that might have been hers if things had turned out otherwise, a longing to be settled, to have a home she could call her own, a secure place in the world. But she was increasingly persuaded this would never happen now, that she would always be a guest in the lives of others, compelled to shape herself to whatever was required of her by those on whom she depended. It was, however, true that her opinion of Mr. Collins had changed during their time in the library. She had grown used to his company, and had been surprised to discover that his most irritating traits were far less in evidence when he was not seeking to impress an audience. He had been a patient instructor, and his open appreciation of her understanding had been very gratifying. No one had ever praised her before with such unfeigned enthusiasm. Mary smiled bitterly in the dark as she considered that she felt more warmly disposed towards him now than she had ever done when she had hoped to make herself his wife. He was an altogether more sympathetic figure than he had appeared then, not least because she knew that he was unhappy, and that aroused her pity. But that was the limit of her affections. There was nothing more between them than the friendship of like-minded scholars. What must happen next, therefore, seemed unfair to them both, but she knew it must be done, and quickly, before her spirits failed her. In the event, Mr. Collins was engaged with business until after tea, and it was not until late afternoon that she opened the door to the library and found him already at his desk, pen and paper in front of him.
"Come, Miss Bennet, this will not do. We have verbs to decline and cases to learn."
She sat down, unable to meet his smile. "I'm afraid, Mr. Collins, that I do not think we can continue with the lessons. I think it is no longer fitting that we spend so much time together." He was so surprised that it was a moment before he spoke.
"Miss Bennet, whatever can you mean? There can be no suggestion of any wrongdoing. My character as a clergyman of the Church of England should be enough to dispel any such suspicion. And I always keep the door a little ajar, as you have seen."
"I understand that, sir, and I am hardly the kind of woman to make a man forget what he owes to himself and his family. But I am no longer comfortable to go on as we have. We know we have nothing to reproach ourselves with, but appearances, it seems, are against us." His face fell.
"Has there been talk? Gossip? Has it reached other ears?"
"No," declared Mary with more assurance than she felt. "These are my concerns alone." She hoped this would bring the conversation to an end and began to rise to go. But to her surprise, He stood up and spoke in an unexpectedly measured tone.
"Please stay a moment, Miss Bennet. I beg you will hear me out before you go. I will not attempt to argue with you. If it is your conviction that the lessons must end, then I cannot quarrel with you. Your delicacy does you credit. I admit I see no wrong in them myself, but I am not a courageous man, and although I might say now I wish them to continue, I know myself well enough to suspect that I would not have the resolve to maintain that opinion if I found it seriously challenged."
Mary took her seat again. There was nothing to be heard but the steady tick of her father's clock on the mantelpiece.
"But I cannot allow our time together to end without telling you how very much I have enjoyed it. You have an excellent mind for a woman, and it has been my pleasure to instruct you."
She tried to speak, but he held out his hand to stop her.
"More than that, your company has been enjoyable to me in every possible way. To have someone to talk to who appears to find interest in my conversation, who does not disdain or ignore me, that has been a new sensation, one, I regret to say, which has not often been vouchsafed me."
He walked to the window and stood staring out at the rooks in the trees.
"I have always known I did not possess a talent for making friends. My father, you know, was a bitter and disappointed man. There were many things that made him angry, but chief among them, I fear, was myself. He made it plain enough I was the worst of the many vicissitudes life had inflicted on him. He told me often enough I was worthless, and I soon learned to take myself at his valuation. Then he died, and I thought it within my power to change my life forever."
Mary was astonished at the unexpected turn of his conversation. She sensed these were confessions he had not volunteered to anyone before, but she did not rush away, as she had intended. He had been kind to her, and she owed him her honest attention.
"So what did you do, sir?"
"I went up to the university. I was ordained. I thought once I went into the world I could turn myself into someone different. Easy and obliging, but it did not work. Other men seemed to have the knack of it, but I could not see how it was done. I was stiff and odd and awkward. No matter how hard I tried, I always struck, and I suspect still continue to strike, the wrong note."
Mary looked down, embarrassed.
"I longed to be what I saw others were, charming and always ready with a pleasing remark. For a while I thought I could learn what came naturally to others. I imagined that if I acquired the appearance of confidence, the reality would follow. It never did, of course. And yet I worked so hard at it. Do you remember your father asking me once at dinner if I made up in advance the compliments I then thought were so pleasing to ladies? I was such a fool that I told him the truth. Of course I did. How else would they occur to a man such as myself?"
It had begun to grow darker in the room as dusk came on. Outside, Mary heard the cattle pass down the lane to their evening milking.
"I consoled myself with imagining how different life would be when I inherited Longbourn. Then I should have a fine house and a fine wife, for I never doubted the prospect of one would produce the other. And now I have both, and I find myself no less solitary than I was when I had neither."
He sighed, but did not turn round.
"There is my William, of course. My hope is that as he grows older, I may have more success with him than has been my lot with everyone else, and that he may come to like me a little. That prospect has sustained me in some of my most unhappy moments. Otherwise, I thought myself resigned. I expected nothing more."
Suddenly, he turned away from the window and looked directly at Mary.
"But then you arrived, and we began our lessons. I did not think much of it at first, but you were clever and eager, and I liked that. I was easy in your presence, I found myself happy when we were together.
Oh, sir, please don't say any more. It makes me so sad.
Our minds are congenial. Our tastes are similar. I began to think how different my life might have been if I had been less foolish when I first arrived here looking for a wife. I did not understand then what makes a marriage work. I did not see what was right before my eyes. If I had not been so thoughtless or so hasty, I might have chosen someone who, in time, could perhaps have learned to love me. I might have chosen you.
Mary could not speak. Two emotions rose up in her, with such power that she closed her eyes, waiting for them to abate a little so that she could control herself again. The first was pity. It moved her very much to see Mr. Collins expose his secret self to her, to confess his loneliness and despair. She was no stranger to such sensations, and they provoked in her the strongest response of fellow feeling. But at the same time, she found herself consumed with rage, with a fury so intense that she wanted to hammer her fists at him, to shout and scream, "Why were you so blind? Why didn't you see me when I did all I could to make you notice? Why did you not understand that of all of them, I was the only one who might have suited you? Why didn't you ask me? Then I would be here and settled and secure and content, and we would have lived better together than you do now, because I would have been more grateful, kinder than she is." But she took a few deep breaths and looked up, certain of what had to be said. "I am very touched, Mr. Collins, by your words. You speak so warmly that I cannot fail to be moved. Like you, I have not been used to much affection, and for those reasons will always think fondly of what you have said. But I think you understand as well as I do that nothing can come of it." She picked up the little Greek dictionary and held it in her hand as she spoke. "I too have greatly enjoyed our lessons and have found much pleasure in your company. But I beg you, sir, not to let that enjoyment run away with you. I think you see me in far too rosy a light. I fear my main attraction is one of variety. I am like a twist of salt and pepper, a new flavour in a habit of life that has become very familiar to you. I'm sure that once you grew accustomed to me, my shortcomings and irritations would become only too apparent." Mr. Collins tried to interrupt, but Mary did not allow it. "It makes me very miserable to see you so sad. But in truth, I think you have the prospect of happiness within your grasp if you choose to reach for it. I have no doubt Charlotte has the capacity to become the wife you want, the companion you say you long for. She is steady and generous and good-hearted, and I'm sure she yearns for affection just as you do. May I suggest you talk to her as you have talked to me over the last few weeks? And then I am sure you will not fail in what you hope for." Suddenly her voice shook. "I have said all I can say. I am sorry, but now I really must go." She left the room hurriedly, and Mr. Collins did not attempt to stop her. Once she had gone, he sat for a while at the window before closing the shutters against the darkening evening. On the far side of the garden, Charlotte sat on a small bench which offered a clear view into the library. From there, she had watched her husband and Mary engage in such animated conversation that neither noticed her dim presence as dusk enveloped her. For a while, she stared at the ground, motionless, until it grew too cold to remain. Only then did she return to the house, gathering her shawl around her shoulders, her step as determined as the expression on her face. Chapter 42. For the next few days, Mary took great pains to avoid Mr. Collins after their conversation, hoping it would not be apparent to anyone but herself that she was doing so. She sensed he was doing the same. When they passed on the stairs, he could not meet her eye, but bowed his head and turned away. At the dinner table, he was cordial but distant, confining his conversation to polite inquiries about how Miss Bennet had spent her day. To Mary's surprise, It was Charlotte who was now most vocal, chatting away about young William's doings, filling the silences that might otherwise have loomed with embarrassing significance between them. She never referred to the sudden discontinuance of the lessons in the library. Indeed, she seemed to have recovered all the affability and warmth with which she had greeted Mary at her arrival. At first, Mary was puzzled. She did not entirely understand the change in Charlotte's manner, but she decided to follow her lead and respond with equal cheerfulness. Perhaps, she thought, the storm had passed, and things could return to the way they were. She ardently wished this might be so, and sometimes, as she watched the Collinses together, she allowed herself to believe her hopes were justified. Certainly, Charlotte seemed far more engaged with her husband. She smiled at him more often, listened to his conversation with more interest, and even touched his hand occasionally as they sat at the table. From beneath lowered eyelids, Mary watched Mr. Collins's expression change from surprise to gratitude, tentative feelings of pleasure visible on his face whenever Charlotte offered him some mark of affection. Some of the anxiety which had tormented Mary since Mrs. Hill's warning began to disperse, and she allowed herself to hope the worst was over. One afternoon, soon after, she met Charlotte in the hall, tying on her apron, a pair of gardening gloves in her basket, and a large notebook in her hand.
"I'm afraid, Mary, you will be left to your own devices until supper. Mr. Collins and I will be in the garden for as long as the weather holds. I have been considering the new arbour, and am resolved to make it as elegant and inviting as possible. I have even drawn up some plans. What do you think?"
She opened the notebook and passed it to Mary, who turned over the pages gravely.
"I think it looks charming. It will be a great addition to Longbourn." "Yes, we think so. I have always felt the want of one before. Fortunately, Mr. Collins finds my ideas exactly to his taste. He says they have given him a new enthusiasm for the work, which I must say does not surprise me. I never think it is a good idea to leave important matters entirely in the hands of husbands. Even the best of them can be led astray. Sometimes they need guidance to see clearly what is the best solution to any little difficulties they may have encountered."
She put on her hat and tied it under her chin.
"But then, which of us can say we haven't sometimes lost sight of what is required of us? I'm sure I have been as guilty of it as Mr. Collins."
She pulled on the gardening gloves, brisk and workmanlike.
"The arbour might be considered a standing affront in that respect, a monument to our dilatoriness, if you like. But all that's behind us now. In future, we shall combine our forces, work together to make it a thing of beauty. The fresh air will do us both good. If you choose, please feel free to spend your time in the library. I think you will have it to yourself from now on."
With a final bright smile, Charlotte walked into the sunlit garden. Mary stood in the hall, watching her go before making her way to the library. There she took up her Aristotle, but could not settle. The silence which had once seemed a natural accompaniment to study now made her feel lonely and restless. She missed the easy exchange of opinions, the sound of another voice. With no like-minded companion to encourage her, the Greek alphabet no longer brought her the pleasure it had once done. It gave no satisfaction to pronounce it when there was no one to correct her. She struggled on for an hour or so, and then wandered over to the window. In the distance, she saw Mr. and Mrs. Collins at work on the arbour. He leant on his spade whilst she marked out on the ground the plans she had drawn up. They seemed happy. Mary sat there for some time, staring at them as the library clock ticked away. Chapter 43. A few nights later at dinner, Mr. Collins announced that they were soon to expect a visitor.
"We are to be honoured with the presence of my erstwhile patroness, Lady Catherine de Bourgh. She is travelling to Derbyshire next week and has expressed a desire to break her journey here for a few hours to see for herself how my dear Charlotte and I get on in our new home."
"We are delighted at her condescension," murmured Charlotte, not catching her husband's eye.
Indeed we are. The only misfortune, a very grave one in my opinion, is that I cannot be here myself to greet her. The bishop has called a meeting of his clergy on that day, and though I have begged him to release me from the obligation, his lordship is implacable. But I have written to her ladyship, explaining the unfortunate circumstance, and she has graciously indicated her willingness to be entertained by Mrs. Collins alone on this occasion.
He smiled at Charlotte, who reached across the cloth and took his hand.
I have no doubt that you will acquit yourself admirably, my dear. As I'm sure will you, Miss Bennet. Lady Catherine does not stand on ceremony, and you can expect the privilege of being introduced to her.
Mary smiled politely, with a confidence she did not feel. She had heard a great deal from Lizzie about Lady Catherine, and suspected her famous condescension would not be extended to plain, unmarried girls like herself. It would be best, she thought, to attract as little attention as possible, to do or say nothing at all that might provoke either Lady Catherine's interest or disdain, for the first, she was sure, must in her case invariably lead to the latter. Next morning, as the house was readied to receive its grand visitor, Mary had ample opportunity to practice the art of disappearance. Charlotte did not invite her to assist in the preparations, and Mary did not force her presence upon her. She was uncertain what to make of Charlotte's shifting mood, sometimes cheerful, sometimes chilly and correct. It seemed easier simply to absent herself whenever she could, and she spent much of her time seeking out places where she should not be in the way. She was walking through the garden towards the orchard when she came upon Mr. Collins approaching from the other direction, to the discomfiture of them both.
Oh, Miss Bennet, I do beg your pardon. Believe me, it was not my intention to come upon you unawares.
Oh, no, sir, it is my fault entirely. It is your garden, after all.
His face softened. She sought to walk on as quickly as she could, but before she could do so, he addressed her.
I do not wish to add to your embarrassment, but please allow me to say a word to you. I am conscious my behaviour in the library last week was not as it should have been, and I have long hoped to find a moment when I might seek your forgiveness. I am sorry if I caused you pain, although I cannot apologise for telling you how much I have enjoyed your company, for that was the truth.
That is kind of you to say, sir, but...
No, please don't think I intend to repeat any other observations which escaped me that afternoon. All I wish is to thank you for the advice you so wisely offered me as you left. It was of inestimable benefit. I have already begun to act upon it, with, I venture to hope, encouraging results. I will always be grateful to you for both your delicacy and your perception. I shall not trouble you further.
With that, he bowed and walked quickly away. Mary did not see him again until she watched from her bedroom window as his horse was brought round and he rode off to his appointment with the bishop. Shortly afterwards, a grand and well-appointed carriage rolled up the drive. Mary straightened her dress and went downstairs, as prepared as she supposed she would ever be to meet Lady Catherine de Bourgh. She waited in the drawing-room, keen not to usurp Charlotte's privilege of standing on the steps to greet her guest. Soon Lady Catherine swept into the room, tall, imperious, clad in the most beautiful silks Mary had ever seen. She seated herself in the best chair, from which she surveyed everything around her with an unblinking stare.
"I must congratulate you, Mrs. Collins, on the improvements you have made to this room since I saw it last. It has elegance without presumption, comfort without any unsuitable pretensions to fashion. You may tell Mr. Collins it has my entire approval, with the exception, I'm afraid, of the curtains at those south-facing windows. The sun will fade the chintz. You must replace them with something lighter."
"Thank you, ma'am, for such sound advice. Before I bring in some refreshments, may I be permitted to introduce you to Miss Mary Bennet, who is staying with us here? She lived here at Longbourn with her family before Mr. Collins and I arrived."
Lady Catherine looked long and hard at Mary.
You are a sister of the present Mrs. Darcy. You do not much resemble her.
No, ma'am. I have heard that said before. I am very pleased to make your acquaintance. Elizabeth has often spoken to me of you.
Lady Catherine frowned.
Has she indeed? I should be glad to hear it was in polite and respectful terms. She has a most particular way of expressing herself. As you clearly do not share her looks, it is to be hoped you have also failed to inherit the pertness of her manners.
I have never heard Mrs. Darcy speak of you with anything but the greatest consideration. Lady Catherine declined to say more upon the vexed subject of Mrs. Darcy. Tea was brought in, and she was persuaded to accept a small slice of cake. When both had been compared to their disadvantage with what was to be had at Rosings, and Charlotte duly instructed to find both a better grocer and a more skilled cook, Lady Catherine turned her attention back to Mary.
What is the purpose of your visit, Miss Bennet? How long do you intend to stay?
Miss Bennet is welcome to stay with us for as long as she wishes, said Charlotte smoothly. There will always be a place for her in what was once her home.
And I suppose it might still be so now, if it had not been for that unfortunate entail. I wonder your father did not find a way to have it broken. A clever lawyer can manage anything, if given the right encouragement. It is a very hard fate for your mother and sisters to be left so sadly unprovided for.
It is not quite as bleak as that, ma'am. All my sisters are married now, and both Mrs. Bingley and Mrs. Darcy have offered my mother a comfortable home.
Yes, your two eldest sisters married very advantageously, and that, despite the scandal of the youngest one's elopement. That was cleverly hushed up, was it not? Where does she live now?
Mrs. Wickham is at Newcastle with her husband's regiment. My other sister, Catherine, married a clergyman in Derbyshire.
How very convenient for her to be so near the others. So that just leaves you.
Charlotte reached out to fill Lady Catherine's teacup. Indeed, Lady Catherine, Mary is the only Bennet daughter as yet unmarried.
And what do you propose to do about that, Miss Bennet? Your looks are against you, and I understand your father had almost nothing to leave you. No portion and no beauty will not make you a very enticing prospect for most young men.
Forgive me, ma'am, but I think you underestimate Miss Bennet, declared Charlotte in her sweetest tone. She has many excellent qualities, of which your ladyship may not be aware. She is too modest to say so herself, but she is without doubt the most accomplished young lady in the neighbourhood. She plays the piano very well and is an excellent scholar. She is well read in every subject, from history to philosophy to theology. She has lately begun to study Greek.
Greek! Exclaimed Lady Catherine. Surely not. That is a most unsuitable pursuit for a young lady. Had I been consulted, I should certainly have advised against it. The classics are rightly considered the exclusive preserve of gentlemen.
At last Mary found her voice, and sought to rescue herself from the forbidding impression created by Charlotte's unstinting praise. Mrs. Collins is far too generous in her estimation of my abilities. It is true I am of a bookish turn of mind, and I enjoy the time I spend at the piano, but I fear my enjoyment of both far outruns what I am capable of achieving.
Your lack of pride does you great credit, Miss Bennet, and marks you out as a very different character to your elder sister.
Indeed, continued Charlotte, Mary has been a most accommodating guest, always willing to fall in with the wishes of others, and never putting herself forward. It only makes it more unfortunate that she has as yet no permanent home where she could be appreciated as she deserves.
Shocked, Mary turned towards Charlotte, who, busy with the tea things, did not return her look. Lady Catherine, taking another slice of the despised cake, noticed nothing at all.
Yes, I cannot imagine you would be welcomed into the household at Pemberley. I doubt they have any desire to admit another into the tight little circle they have established there. and I don't imagine you wish to settle in too close a proximity to your mother. Your two younger sisters, for different reasons, offer no solution. You find yourself in difficult circumstances, Miss Bennet.
I am grateful to your ladyship for your consideration, but I have not decided what I will do next. I do not as yet feel as concerned for my prospects as you do.
You are not overburdened with choices,
continued Lady Catherine, as if Mary had not spoken.
But there is one situation for which you seem to me admirably suited. Mrs. Collins may not have told you that I am particularly interested in assisting young ladies with the talents and capacity to become governesses.
Charlotte inclined her head slightly, but said nothing. Mary felt fear rise in her.
I always say, continued Lady Catherine, that nothing is to be done in education without steady and regular instruction, and nobody but a governess can supply it. It is wonderful how many families I have been the means of supplying in that way.
But I don't want to become a governess, protested Mary weakly. I do not think I am at all suited to it. I know I would dislike it extremely.
I have just placed four nieces of Mrs. Jenkinson, all unmarried and likely to stay so, in the most delightful situations. Only the other day I recommended another young person who was merely accidentally mentioned to me, and the family are quite delighted with her.
Really, ma'am, I do beg you not to think of me in that way. My inclination does not lie in that direction at all.
Mrs. Collins, did I tell you of Lady Metcalfe's calling yesterday to thank me? She finds Miss Pope a treasure. Lady Catherine, she said, you have given me such a treasure. I think, Miss Bennet, that you have it within yourself to become exactly such a treasure as Miss Pope.
Forgive me for contradicting you, ma'am, but I fear that is not the case. I cannot say too often it is not a life I should want for myself. For a moment, Lady Catherine regarded Mary with incomprehension.
But come, Miss Bennet, what do you propose instead? You are a plain woman, with no money, inclined to be clever. We have already established marriage is unlikely for you. Do you wish to remain a burden on your friends and family for the rest of your life? No. Depend upon it. Governessing is the answer. Once you have considered it, you will see I am right. Mrs. Collins, I am most grateful to you for introducing Miss Bennet to me. It will be my pleasure to find her a place, and to do so with the utmost dispatch. Once a decision has been made in these matters, it does not do to delay.
For the rest of her stay, Lady Catherine was almost gracious, wholly satisfied by the prospect of meddling in the life of a woman powerless to resist her. She was in the highest of spirits as she took her leave.
I thank you, Mrs. Collins, for a most enjoyable and, may I say, productive afternoon. Miss Bennet, I shall write to you as soon as I have news, which will not, I think, be long in coming. No, do not thank me now. Await until you are properly settled before conveying your gratitude to me.
Chapter 44 Mary did not accompany Charlotte to the door to see Lady Catherine depart. She crumbled the remains of a piece of cake between her fingers, growing increasingly uneasy as she waited for Charlotte to return.
I thought that went very well,
declared Charlotte as she bustled back into the room.
Lady Catherine seemed very taken with you. I really do believe she will exert herself to find a suitable situation for you.
For the first time since she had been at Longbourn, Mary raised her voice.
But she is offering me something I do not want, which I am sure would make me unhappy. Charlotte, you cannot imagine I want to become a governess. Why ever did you put the thought into her mind?
Charlotte felt the side of the teapot and decided it was just warm enough to risk another cup. She offered one to Mary, who shook her head.
If I did, it was quite unintended. But once it was mentioned, I cannot deny I saw its advantages. You have always been proud of your accomplishments and worked hard to perfect them. Why should they not serve to recommend you now?
Because they are being used to usher me into a life I would hate. I do not wish to live in some other person's house, dependent on their goodwill and with not a moment to call my own.
Charlotte sipped her tea. No, I see it is not without its difficulties. But, and I feel I must be blunt, Mary, your situation at present is in many ways not so different. You have no settled home. Neither of the possibilities offered by Jane or Lizzie in Derbyshire is to your liking. I understand your reluctance, but it leaves you few other choices. Kitty has no room, and Lydia, well, that is plainly out of the question. So where will you go? Of course, you are welcome to stay with us as our guest, but I think we both understand that cannot be a lasting solution.
She wiped her hands on her napkin and began to fold it neatly on the plate.
In such circumstances, I think you must ask yourself whether it would not be desirable to have some occupation, at least until you decide on some other course of action. I must warn you that once Lady Catherine has an idea in her head, it is very difficult to resist her. So, if you have some other notion in mind, I would urge you to act upon it as soon as you can.
Mary's face was hot with humiliation. She put her head in her hands to hide her misery. To her surprise, Charlotte pulled her chair towards her and laid her arm gently on her shoulder.
I know it looks as though I am determined to cause you pain, but I assure you that is not the case. I tried once before to make you see the world as it is. I know it took you a while to accept my advice, and I know you felt I had betrayed you by seizing an opportunity you had just begun to appreciate, that I had opened your eyes to a possibility only to snatch it away for myself. I tried my best to explain. I told you then that despite all the sympathy I felt for you, I had no choice but to put my own interests first, that sometimes women like us are obliged to be selfish. And now I find I am obliged to be selfish again. I see only too plainly that you are in a difficult place, and I am sorry for it, but I cannot allow you to disrupt our life here.
She removed her arm, sat back, and sighed.
In some respects, I will admit this, interlude, shall we call it, has actually been of service to me. It made me look again at my own behaviour. I knew that when I married I was not in love. I told you that I was never romantic. But I see now that I might have been more kind. You have shown me that I have it in my power to make our lives together more pleasant than they have been, which I think will benefit me quite as much as Mr. Collins. He would like to be better friends with me, if I would permit it, and I think we shall both go on more happily if I do. For this, Mary, I must thank you. It was not a consequence you intended to bring about, but I am grateful to you nonetheless.
Charlotte picked up her teacup and sipped her tea delicately.
But I'm afraid there is far more chance of our achieving that contentment if you are not here. There. I have done you the honour of being candid. I have always thought the best help I could do for you was to tell the truth as I saw it. So here is the last piece of advice I will ever offer you. Make a decision, and make it a bold one. Perhaps it may be to start a new life as a governess, perhaps not. But I urge you to find some way of beginning again, to put yourself amongst fresh scenes and different people. Imagine a new future for yourself. Only then, I think, will you have any chance of escaping your past.
Mary wiped her eyes. Charlotte's frankness had been refreshing in its way. It forced her to think rationally, to gain control of her emotions.
Thank you, Charlotte. I will go away and consider what you've said. I have probably said far too much, but I assure you it was meant kindly.
Chapter 45. Mary did not think she could endure dinner that night. Instead, she sat alone in her room, trying to decide what to do. It was clearly impossible for her to remain at Longbourn. Charlotte had been honest, but she was also implacable. But where was she to go? Pemberley was out of the question, and her courage failed her when she imagined returning to the Bingleys, subjected once more to the complaints of her mother and Caroline Bingley's torments. No, she did not think she could bear it. But who else could she ask? It was not until the following morning that a new possibility occurred to her. Perhaps the gardeners might take her. Her uncle and aunt were, without doubt, the most generous of her relations. Mr. Gardiner was everything his sister, Mrs. Bennet, was not, open-hearted and cheerful, without pretense or affectation of any kind. His wife was equally kind and affectionate. Their residing in London had meant Mary had not seen them herself for some years, but she had heard much from Jane and Elizabeth of the thoughtful consideration which they had extended to both sisters when they had been troubled and needed to escape the confines of Longbourn. Mr. and Mrs. Gardiner had happily offered them refuge in their home when it had been most needed. Perhaps they would be prepared to accept Mary on similar terms. The more she considered this possibility, the more hopeful she became. After Mr. Bennet's death, Mary had received from Mrs. Gardiner a letter of condolence in which her sincere regret at Mary's loss and her frank appreciation of the difficulties of her situation had touched her very much. It had concluded with an invitation to visit them whenever she wished. Mrs. Gardiner understood that, as Mary had not been very much in London, the prospect of staying with them there might seem a very formidable step. But she was to understand that their house at Gracechurch Street was always to be thought of as a second home to her if she wished to join them there. It was quickly plain to Mary that the Gardiners were her best and indeed only hope. She did not find it easy to write the letter proposing herself as a guest to them, but the prospect of another encounter with Lady Catherine overcame any shrinking sense of delicacy that might once have troubled her. She knew she must get away before that lady ushered her firmly into a schoolroom, ignoring all her protests and delightedly closing the door behind her. Mary did not know what might become of her in London, but she was pleased to discover that she had courage enough to prefer an uncertain future to one she knew would make her unhappy. By the end of the week, she had her answer, and it was just as she had hoped. Mrs. Gardiner replied they would be delighted to see her and that she should come as soon as she found it convenient. They would give her a room at the back of the house where the noise of the city was least likely to trouble her, and if she could contrive to get herself on the coach for Meryton, Mr. Gardiner would be happy to meet her at Charing Cross. Charlotte received Mary's news with equanimity. She offered no comment on her decision, other than offering to write to Lady Catherine, explaining that family circumstances had called Mary away from Hertfordshire, making it impossible for her to take up her ladyship's kind offer to find her a situation. Indeed, now she was certain Mary was leaving, much of Charlotte's old warmth returned. She made sure her clothes were properly packed, helped her gather up her books, lent her the money to pay the coach fare, and even included a part of her lavender-scented floor polish as a gift for Mrs. Gardiner. Mrs. Hill was far more distressed to see her go.
"I should hate to think the conversation we had a while ago was the reason for your leaving. I never intended to make trouble for you."
"No, Mrs. Hill, none of this is your fault. If it is anyone's, it is mine. There were things I did not see clearly, and your words made me more aware of the risk I ran."
"You should not take all the blame upon yourself. Excuse me if I say I think Mr. Collins might have acted more carefully."
"I think both of us were in error," said Mary sadly. "I was foolish. I thought I had found a friend, someone with whom to share my interests, who seemed to enjoy instructing me. It never occurred to me that any other construction might be put upon the time we spent together. I am not the sort of woman that men fall in love with."
You think too little of yourself. It makes me sad to hear it.
Well, then, I will say no more. But I am glad to see that Mr. and Mrs. Collins seemed far more contented with each other than used to be the case.
Through the window, the couple were just visible in the garden, occupied as ever around the little arbour. Charlotte stood, plans in hand, whilst her husband positioned a sapling. William ran around them, laughing and shouting at the top of his voice. Mrs. Hill suddenly seized Mary's hands and held them tightly.
One day, I shall see you come back here as a married woman. I'm sure of it. It is what you deserve. And when it happens, I shall drink to your health with the greatest joy.
Mary leant over and kissed her cheek.
Shall we ask Mr. Hill to come up and take down my bags?
A short while later, Mary stood on the front steps, watching as her possessions were loaded onto the coach. Soon she was ready to go. All the family were assembled to see her off. William gave her a sticky kiss. Charlotte pecked her cheek and urged her to write as soon as she reached London, and Mr. Collins made his usual bow. He had said very little to her since she announced her intention of leaving. She supposed he felt a little ashamed now of the intimacy they had shared in the library. But he held out his hand to help her into the carriage, and once she was settled, without a word, he placed a small parcel on the seat beside her, before returning to stand alongside his wife and child. All three waved as the carriage pulled away. Mary waved back, gazing back at the house as it receded slowly into the distance. As she watched the figures of Mr. and Mrs. Collins grow smaller and smaller, it struck her that Charlotte's new attitude to her husband in many ways resembled her ambitions for Longbourn itself. She had acquired both as unimproved properties. There were exterior elements that did not please, but she was astute enough to appreciate that the basic structures of both were sound. A woman of vision and patience might shape something of value from such raw materials, and although the result might never aspire to the heights of fashion or display a thousand graceful details, it could be made solid and dependable, offering comfort and security to those satisfied with such unobtrusive virtues. Charlotte dearly loved a project, and Mary had no doubt she would succeed as admirably with Mr. Collins as she had done with Longbourn. The coach was well onto the Meryton Road before Mary remembered the little package. She undid it carefully, peeling back the wrappings before revealing the little Greek dictionary. A small slip of paper poked out from between its pages. On it was a line of writing in Mr. Collins's hand. She had to slip on her glasses before she saw that it was in Greek. It took a few minutes and recourse to the dictionary before she was certain she understood what it said, but she recognised the quotation. It was one they had often discussed together. "Happiness depends on ourselves." She took off her glasses and leant her cheek against the cold window. She had been determined not to cry when she arrived at Longbourn, and would not give in to tears now she was leaving. She took the slip of paper, placed it carefully in the dictionary, and put both safely in her bag. The carriage rolled on through the countryside as she tried not to think of what might lie in front of her. Tomorrow she would be in London, and Longbourn would seem very far away.
Part 3. Chapter 46.
It was dark when Mary arrived at Gracechurch Street. The coach had been full, the journey long and tedious. Mary was exhausted as she was ushered into the gardener's dining room, convinced she could not manage supper. But the lively greetings of her four small nephews and nieces cheered her, and the genuine affection with which her uncle shook her hand and her aunt embraced her buoyed up her spirits. To her own surprise, she found herself able to consume a surprising amount of toasted cheese before gratefully climbing the stairs to bed. Mrs. Gardiner had been as good as her word and given Mary a room at the back of the house. It was indeed quieter than those at the front,
but Mary's countrified ears were nevertheless aware of a distant bustle of human activity taking place just out of earshot. As she finally drifted off to sleep, she could be in no doubt that she was really in London now. She had asked for this opportunity, and it had been granted her. She must do all she could to be worthy of it. The gardener's house was built of yellow London bricks and rose tall and thin behind black railings, with a dark green door and high windows on each floor. It stood in a side road, but a few steps carried you quickly into Gracechurch Street, whilst a longer stroll delivered the walker into the very heart of Cheapside. Mary had long ago heard her uncle declare that these were the two finest shopping streets in London, possibly in all of Europe, and anything that could be desired, from the homeliest necessity to the grandest indulgence, was to be had in one or other of them, if the customer had the money to pay for it. As they sat at breakfast and Mary sipped her coffee, Mr. Gardiner proudly repeated this boast. Mary suspected it was a favourite theme of his, but his wife gave no sign she had heard it before. She smiled as her husband continued, describing in ever greater detail the range of goods which could be purchased, the luxury of the establishments that sold them, and the ingenuity of the merchants who supplied them. "Mr. Gardiner's little quirks and habits do not vex and annoy her," observed Mary. "They provoke her indulgence, not her anger." "Well, Mary," declared Mrs. Gardiner as she folded her napkin and placed it on her plate, "you have heard so much talk of these wonders that you must long to see them for yourself. You were a mere child when we last took you amongst them." "I remember a great toy shop," said Mary wistfully, "a vast palace of dolls, as I recall."
"Oh, yes, that would be Dunnett's," replied Mr. Gardiner, "a place with which our children are very well acquainted."
As soon as the magical name was uttered, a loud clamour arose at the younger end of the table, with four voices begging to know if they were to be taken there today, for they surely deserved it, as they had been so very good. Leaving her husband to adjudicate on the rights and wrongs of their case, Mrs. Gardiner pulled her chair away from her children and towards Mary, the better to make herself heard.
"Mr. Gardiner is quite right," she said. "The city shops truly are one of the great sights of the town. Shall we go this morning and take a look?"
Mary readily agreed, and an hour later she found herself hurrying in Mrs. Gardiner's wake as her aunt launched herself into the crowds thronging Gracechurch Street. Some shoppers marched briskly forward with a clear purpose, their minds set on a particular purchase, but by far the greater number seemed happy to saunter about, moving idly from one shop to another, lingering to peer into their well-stocked windows. As she dawdled behind her aunt, Mary found herself joining them, transfixed by the sheer number and variety of the goods on show. In little more than a few paces, she was lured in by stockings, hats, fur tippets, and stoles, to fine shoes, gold jewellery, watches, and even ironmongery. How Charlotte Collins would have enjoyed half an hour amongst those grates and firebacks, thought Mary, almost fondly. At the door of every shop, smartly dressed young men invited customers politely to step in. It was impossible to show all they had in the window. There were even finer things to be seen inside. Mary thought she had never seen so many people. It was amazing that they did not trip over each other, and yet everyone seemed to know exactly where to move so as not to collide with each other. Gradually, she began to fall into their pace. It was rather like a dance, which made sense once the steps had been mastered, and the bustle and busyness which had at first intimidated her began to feel invigorating. She had just begun to enjoy herself when Mrs. Gardiner came abruptly to a halt before an especially magnificent frontage.
"There!" she declared proudly. "What do you think of that?"
It was at least 10 years since Mary had last stood before the premises of Edward Gardiner and Sons, purveyors of fine household linens. It had seemed imposing even then, with its many floors and grand pillared entrance. Now it was much smarter than Mary remembered, with an elegant frontage which had not been there before, and striped awnings extended over the pavement to protect customers from the rain. Behind one of the large glass windows were displayed sweeping lengths of plain linens in every shade, from a milky cream to a sturdy brown. A second window was full of patterned jacquards, arranged from deepest red to palest pink. A printed notice, prominently positioned, begged to inform customers that all requirements could be catered for, from the most elaborate damasks to the hardest-wearing calicoes. Even stuffs not presently on show might be obtained if requested. Mrs. Gardiner stood, slowly contemplating the building floor by floor, from roof to basement, as if she had never seen it before. Finally, she turned to Mary with an expression in which pride and satisfaction were equally combined.
"Even though I say it myself, it does look very smart."
Mary followed her aunt's appreciative gaze, taking in the size of the shop, the quality of the materials it sold, and its general air of prosperity. These well-appointed premises, she thought, explained the solid, polished comfort of the Gracechurch Street house. The gilt mirrors above every fireplace, the many portraits of the gardeners that decorated its walls, capturing them singly, together, and as a happy family group, master and mistress of their small domestic empire, their children frolicking around them. This was the business that underwrote the matching china on which breakfast, tea, and dinner were served, the cutlery with their initials engraved upon it, the rich rugs on the floors, and the Chinese wallpaper in the drawing room. The unassuming fabrics laid out before Mary in rolls, lengths, and bales made possible the commodious beds, the best mattress Mary had ever slept upon, the heavy linen sheets, and the silk quilts. The unobtrusive well-being that marked every aspect of the gardeners' lives had its origins here. The warehouses paid for it all.
"I've seldom seen a finer place," Mary finally replied. "You must be very proud."
"I am indeed," answered Mrs. Gardiner simply. "It has not always been easy, but for the moment, at least, I feel our efforts have been rewarded." "You think of yourself and Mr. Gardiner as partners in the enterprise, then?"
"Oh, of course. We women are barred by custom and a thousand other petty considerations from attempting such an undertaking alone. But I flatter myself that Mr. Gardiner could not have succeeded as he has without my help. He has often told me that my judgment in matters of taste, quality, and prices has been of the utmost use to him."
The shopman standing at the door suddenly recognised Mrs. Gardiner and made her a deep and very respectful bow. She acknowledged him with equal solemnity, then paused for a moment as if considering her reply.
"So yes, like all the best businesses, and I might say the best marriages too, Mr. Gardiner and I are indeed a partnership."
No one, Mary reflected, could have described her own parents' union in such a way. The recollection was painful to her, and to avoid dwelling upon it further, she asked whether they might perhaps go inside the shop and look around. Mrs. Gardiner thought not at present. They must make their way home, for the children's lessons must be begun before midday, but she should be very glad to take Mary on another occasion.
"And of course," she added teasingly, "when you have a house of your own to furnish, I shall be glad to show you the very best linens you can possibly require. We shall roam the warehouses together. It will be my pleasure."
Mary could produce no answering smile, but Mrs. Gardiner seemed not to notice.
"In the meantime, however, there are plenty of beautiful things more suited to your present circumstances. There are some lovely printed cottons to be had this year, and some of the prettiest silks I've seen in a long time. Ideal for a young girl like yourself."
Suddenly conscious of her well-worn coat and much-washed dress, Mary gathered both around her a little more tightly.
"I'm not sure I'm suited to finery. I think I'm better with something plain and unassuming."
"Perhaps," said Mrs. Gardiner, "but good things don't need to be showy or gaudy, you know. Sometimes the very best stuff can seem quite plain until one examines it closely, It is only then that one sees its true quality. Their eyes met. Mrs. Gardiner's expression gave nothing away. If she had intended a meaning deeper than what was said, she gave no hint of it.
But just as you wish, let's not talk of it now. Shall we fight our way back home?
She held out her arm. Mary could not remember when anyone had sought to walk with her in such a friendly manner, and hesitated. But Mrs. Gardiner did not withdraw her invitation, and Mary shyly linked her arm with her aunt's. To begin with, it seemed strange. But Mary soon grew accustomed to it, and began to feel how pleasant it was to stroll along in such easy intimacy. Her opinion of Mrs. Gardiner grew warmer with every step. She had often heard Jane and Lizzie sing her praises, and although she had spent only a morning with her, Mary knew for certain now that they had not exaggerated her virtues. Mrs. Gardiner was lively and kind, with a quick mind, and a frank curiosity about the concerns of those for whom she cared. She was inquisitive, but she was not meddlesome. She employed her intelligence to understand what others thought and felt, the better to help them if she could. She wanted those around her to be happy. Entirely satisfied with her own circumstances, it pleased her to see those she loved as contented and comfortable as she was herself. By the time they arrived back at Gracechurch Street, Mary thought she had never met anyone whom it was so easy to like. There seemed no reason not to surrender herself to the full force of her aunt's appeal, and although she was usually cautious in all matters relating to the affections, in this case she felt more confident. Mary was already certain that Mrs. Gardiner was to be trusted, and that her aunt would not let her down. Chapter 47 Family life at Gracechurch Street was very different from what Mary had known at Longbourn. She had not been there long before it was plain that Mrs. Gardiner loved her husband and four children with a strong, steady devotion. Her feelings were fully returned, and neither she nor Mr. Gardiner saw any reason not to express them as openly as possible. At Gracechurch Street, there was affection enough for everyone. With something of a pang, Mary saw that her aunt and uncle had no favourites amongst their children, but treated them all with equal care. They rarely scolded either their two lively daughters or their two cheerful sons, preferring that they should be a little more jolly and bouncing, and a little less disciplined and silent than absolute correctness required. As a consequence, there was in the Gardiner household a great deal of capering and frisking and jumping about, which made it rather too boisterous for very refined spirits. But for anyone in need of a little tenderness, it was a singularly welcoming haven. The longer Mary spent in its soothing surroundings, the more she understood why both Jane and Elizabeth had been so restored there. For whilst Mrs. Gardiner cared deeply about the well-being of her nieces, she understood that when dealing with young women, it was not always wise to demonstrate concern too plainly. It was nearly 20 years since she had left off being a young woman herself, but she had not forgotten how tiresome it was to be constantly poked and prodded with questions. She deduced that something had happened to upset Mary at Longbourn, but did not seek immediately to discover what it was. Instead, she fed her, encouraged her to sleep late in the morning, and generally enveloped her in all the unobtrusive attention of which she was capable. At first, Mary was too dazed to appreciate it, but gradually she understood with what care she was being treated, and after she had been at Gracechurch Street about a week, she attempted to thank Mrs. Gardiner for it. As her gratitude was all she had to offer, Mary was keen to convey it with as much feeling as possible. She composed a little speech in her head, but it was not easy to find the right moment to deliver it. Finally, one morning after breakfast, when their nurse had taken the children away to be washed and dressed, she seized her opportunity. "I wanted to say how very grateful I am for all the kindness you have shown me," she began. "I am all the more sensible of your generosity, for although I invited myself into your house, you have welcomed me with the most open arms imaginable.
It is often said that offering hospitality to strangers is one of the noblest virtues, but there are few who practice it with as much sincerity as you and Mr. Gardiner.
Well, you can hardly be accounted a stranger, replied Mrs. Gardiner.
She was somewhat distracted, occupied in gathering up her children's books from the floor, where they had been strewn by their owners before they were carried off to be made decent.
And I shouldn't want you to feel too heavy a sense of obligation, she continued, stacking the little volumes into a pile on the sofa. We were pleased when you asked if you could come and are very glad to have you here. Your sisters were free to stay with us for as long as they wished, and we are happy to extend the same invitation to you.
I only hope there is some way in which I can repay your kindness, Mary replied. I know I am not as amusing as Lizzie nor as useful as Jane, but there must be something I could do to assist you. Abruptly, Mrs. Gardiner stopped what she was doing and looked up from her sorting.
Mary, I do hate to hear you speak in that way. It makes me so very sad. We would not have asked you here if we did not find your presence agreeable. I hope you understand that.
I'm sorry, Mary faltered. It is only that I did not want to presume.
You are the least presuming person I know,
declared her aunt, as she placed the books alongside the others on the sofa.
And please, let us hear no more disobliging criticisms of your own character. The only condition I shall apply to your remaining with us is that you try to speak more kindly of yourself. Is that a rule you think you can obey?
Mary bit her lip. She could not imagine anything more pleasing than to remain in this welcoming house where she had begun to feel herself at home.
I will certainly try.
These few hesitant words hardly did justice to the strength of her feelings, but before she could say more, the pile of books her aunt had so carefully balanced on the sofa slid slowly but unstoppably back onto the floor. Mrs. Gardiner watched them fall with a resigned smile.
Then you are welcome to stay as long as you wish, or for as long as you can bear it. As you can see, it is a regular Liberty Hall here, and we don't stand on ceremony. But if you don't mind that, I think you'll do well enough. We shall be delighted to have you amongst us.
Mary's heart was too full to speak. Instead, she joined her aunt on the carpet and began to pick up her nephews and nieces' books.